I told him we weren't. This had been a tactical move, since I just finished encouraging him to Google us to prove that we were journalists and not spies. I didn't want to get caught in any sort of lie. Now, though, I couldn't comfort Nigel for fear of igniting the mercurial Ali. I was already worried that he'd separate us for good. In Islamic tradition, an unmarried woman should not be alone with an unmarried man, let alone touch him. I didn't want to take any risks. Instead, I spoke softly to Nigel from a distance, saying all the things I myself wanted to hear. It would be all right, I told him. We'd get out of this place. We had each other. At one point, we'd spotted Abdi and the other two Somali guys being walked at gunpoint across the courtyard. Nigel and I had been wondering whether they'd been in on our kidnapping, whether one or all of them had sold us out. But it looked as if they were being installed in one of the other two rooms in our building, captives like us. I tried to get Nigel to meditate with me, running through the phrases about freedom and peace that I'd listened to a couple of days earlier on the plane from Nairobi, this time saying them aloud. He whispered the words along with me. At some point, we both nodded off in the heat. I slept hard. For how long, I have no idea. Waking up, I enjoyed a quick instant of unknowingness before my surroundings reintroduced themselves. The grubby walls, the tattered mat. Nigel staring at the ceiling from his own mat about 10 feet away. The sound of men speaking a foreign language outside our door. As my mind locked in on the scene, I felt something internal start to plummet. Now what? Our door flew open. Ahmed was back, dressed in clothes he'd worn earlier, accompanied by Ali and two other men. One was tall, wearing Ben Franklin glasses and an orange-striped polo shirt. He held a notepad and pen. He looked to be in his mid-20s, thin and serene-faced, but unable to mask how pleased he was to see us, two trophy animals in a cage. He introduced himself as Adam. "I am the commander," he said. He shook Nigel's hand but made no move to shake mine. When he spoke, it was only with a slight accent. "What is your country?" When Nigel answered, "Australia," Adam wrote it down in the notepad. "What is your village?" he said next. The other man was introduced as Yahya. He was older than the others, with a short white beard and seemed gruff, entirely detached. Something in the way he squared his shoulders made me think he had a military background. I recognized him as the guy who'd driven our car away from the spot where we'd been taken earlier. He was looking with scorn at Nigel's pink paisley shirt. Adam took down our names and professions and addresses. I gave him my father's phone number in Sylvan Lake, wishing I had my mother's number in British Columbia. She would hold up better in a crisis, I knew. Nigel gave a number for his sister, Nikki. Adam smiled and closed his notebook. "Inshallah, this will be over quickly," he said. "You are my brother and my sister." A while later, he returned to the room, offering some good news. "We no longer believe you are spies," he said. Before anyone could get too excited, he tacked on another announcement. "Allah," he said, "has put it into my heart to ask for a ransom." I imagine the calls going through Adam's voice on my dad's line. I couldn't for the life of me imagine what he would say. What words got used? How did arrangements get made? My father had chronic health issues and lived on disability checks. My mother made minimum wage. My bank account was just about empty. My friends in Calgary were mostly waitresses, none of them wealthy. I'm not sure anybody I knew back home could even find Somalia on a map. In Iraq, kidnapping was enough of a worry that it had been a topic of conversation at the Hamra Hotel. The big-time journalists generally had kidnapping insurance through their news organizations. Usually, it would pay for a crisis response company to help negotiate for a hostage's release. Freelancers most often had none. And it was common knowledge that you couldn't rely on your government to get you out. As a rule, governments won't pay off hostage takers. It's too expensive and too loaded. No government wants to be found handing money over to terrorists. It was evening when Nigel and I were allowed out of the room again to use the bathroom and to get some air. Ali ushered us to a straw mat laid out alongside one of the compound's walls. He handed us two more tins of tuna fish and another flask of tea. It seemed clear we'd be spending the night. Calmly, I let go of the idea that this would be a one-day ordeal. It was like putting down one stone and picking up another. This would be a two-day ordeal, I told myself. I could live with that. As darkness fell, the air cooled off somewhat. The sky became a screen, shot through with pinprick stars. Beneath it, I felt small and lost. Over near the lean-to, I could see the soldier boys lolling around. Some sat on the ground, a few had laid themselves out flat. They were listening to a silver battery-operated boombox, having tuned into the BBC Somali service. A male newscaster's voice blared in Somali, delivering what I assumed was news of the war. Then, with bizarre clarity, I heard him say the words, Shamo Hotel. In the lean-to area, the words caused a stir. The soldiers were sitting up and beginning to talk. Ali got to his feet and started waving at us excitedly, pointing toward the radio. The newscaster said, Canadian, and then Australian. My eyes met Nigel's. The news story was about us, for sure. The feeling was crushing. It was confirmation that our troubles were both real and deep. Chapter 18. Ransom. I know now that kidnappings for ransom happen far more frequently than most of us would think. They happen in Mexico, Nigeria, and Iraq. They happen in India, Pakistan, China, Colombia, and plenty of places in between. Sometimes the motivation is political or personal, but most often it's about money, plain and simple. Hostage taking is a business, a speculative one, fed by people like me, the wandering targets, the fish found out of water, the comparatively rich moving against a backdrop of poor. Oil workers in far-off countries, traveling business people, journalists, and tourists, get swiped out of cars or from meetings or are deftly escorted at gunpoint from a restaurant. Back home, you wouldn't know how often it happened if you didn't pay attention to it. The news stories pop up and then disappear. An American traveler gets grabbed in Benin. A Dutch consultant gets held for ransom in Johannesburg. A British tourist is dragged from a bus in Turkey. Families get called. Governments are contacted. A certain machinery quietly goes into gear. Nobody would ever call these situations common, but they happen frequently enough that there are procedures in place, a way things go, at least on the home front. In my case, it was not the kidnappers who alerted my family, but a radio producer in Vancouver who had noticed a thinly reported wire story coming out of Somalia, not 12 hours after we'd been taken. What it said was that two journalists, one Canadian, one Australian, had gone missing outside of Mogadishu. Only our first names were included, but I'd done some work for that producer earlier in the year, giving live radio updates from Iraq, and I'd let him know I was headed to Somalia. Searching for contact information on the internet, the producer had called my uncle in Red Deer, who then rang my father. He and Perry had been sitting, until that moment, in the sun on their back porch. My father called my mother. My mother called my brothers. Nobody was clear on what to do. The radio producer in Vancouver had passed on a number for the Government Office of Foreign Affairs in Ottawa. When my father called it, a staffer explained that while they were aware of what the news said, nothing was confirmed. She then gave a different number for my family to call if they heard anything. She told my father to sit tight. One news report begat another. My father's phone rang and rang with calls from reporters, dozens of them. A couple of TV trucks had parked in the street outside the house. Neighbors gathered on the sidewalk. The phone rang, but my father, feeling overwhelmed, stopped answering. Perry opened the door only to close friends and relatives. Otherwise, they stayed locked up, waiting for something to happen. The first phone call from Somalia came the next morning, a rubbly voice on my father's voicemail, the man who called himself Adam, saying, "Hello, we have your daughter." He said he'd call again to talk about money and then hung up. The call made it official. I hadn't gotten lost or run away. I'd been taken. I had captors, and those captors had demands. I think now of my mother leaving the small house she'd rented in British Columbia. Too rattled to drive, she enlisted a friend to help her make the 10-hour trip through the Rockies to my father's place in Alberta. I imagine the car climbing the crooked road, surrounded by pine forest, my mother perched stiffly in the passenger seat. It was August. The lupine would have been blooming in the dirt along the road's shoulder. The mountains would have carried white veins of snow. Probably there were hawks in the sky. My mother, I would guess, saw none of it. By nightfall, three agents from the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, had arrived in Sylvan Lake and were sitting around the dining room table at my dad and Perry's house, along with my mother. The agents asked questions and took notes. They listened several times to Adam's voice message. They requested permission to tap my parents' phone lines. They offered talking points for what to say when Adam called again. The idea was to try and have Adam put me on the phone, to prove I was alive, to get a sense of how I was being treated, to listen for clues. When it came to money, they were to tell the truth. They had none, and the government wouldn't pay a ransom either. My belongings, my journal, my toothbrush, all my odds and ends left in the Mogadishu hotel room, would soon be shipped to the Canadian Embassy in Nairobi. My parents would receive a typed bullet-pointed list of everything I'd been traveling with. One green shawl, one brown t-shirt, one bathing suit, one Apple MacBook laptop, two pairs of black trousers, one headscarf, one bottle Nivea sunscreen, assorted pens and notebooks, assorted airline itineraries and electronic ticket records, assorted currency from Thailand, India, and Pakistan. My mother would later tell me she pored over the list, examining what was left of me as if it would explain something about why any of this had happened. When it came to the reporters scrumming on my father's front lawn, my parents were instructed to say little, not just to the media but to friends and neighbors as well. The hope was that, starved of fresh information, the news story about my kidnapping would die out quickly. It was better, the agents explained, to be a low-profile captive than a high-profile one. Hostage takers in general are plenty savvy. They know how to Google. They read the news. They, too, would be scanning for clues during those early days, trying to assess the value of their catch. Did my family have money? Did I work for a big, wealthy company? Was I important to my government? A simple stressed-out comment from my mother in the news about how desperately she wanted me back could lead to an immediate hike in ransom. The message from the investigators to my parents was that they were not alone. Teams of trained negotiators would rotate in and out of Sylvan Lake, sleeping on mattresses on the floor, monitoring the phones and coaching my parents 24/7 until it was done. Together, they would work to wrangle, coddle, apply pressure, and offer vague assurances to our captors to hit whatever levers it might take to get me sprung from Somalia. Kidnappings happened, my parents were told, but they also ended. This was meant as reassurance. So was another point the agents made, offering a first bit of comfort in what would turn into months of it. Nigel and I were now commodities. The kidnappers had spent money to catch us and keep us. They'd made an investment, which meant it was in their best interest to keep us alive. If they killed us, it would be their loss, too. In the tin-roofed house in Somalia, of course, we knew none of this. I spent the first day and night of captivity vacillating between panic and something that amounted to faith, a certainty that our ordeal would end quickly if only we could hit upon the right strategy for talking to the men holding us. Early on the second morning, Adam came into our room accompanied by Ali, Yahya, and Ahmed and announced that they had come up with a plan. They would be calling our family shortly to demand a ransom payment. They would be given one day to pay. If no money came, we'd be killed. Immediately I started to argue. I said, "Our families don't have money. They can't pay ransom. And besides that, it's Sunday, and so even if they could, all the banks are closed anyway." Adam was unmoved. When Nigel asked why they were holding us, he smiled and said something about our governments being at war with Islam. "You have bad governments," he said, as if suggesting that we shouldn't take anything personally. He added that they didn't want money from our families. "If we are going to kill you in 24 hours, your government will find a way to pay," he said. I could see he was missing one of his top front teeth. I said, "How much are you asking for?" "Ah," Adam said, as if I'd hit upon something he'd forgotten to mention. "We are not yet certain." He eyed us as if trying to evaluate our worth. "Maybe $1 million, he said, shrugging lightly. "Maybe two." Nigel and I sat in stunned silence while the four men filed back out the door. A few minutes later, we heard a car leaving the compound. We were starting to understand, somewhat, the power structure in the group holding us hostage. Adam and Ahmed appeared to be the leaders, with Yahya, the older military man, and Ali serving as deputies, overseeing the foot soldiers, the group of about 10 long-legged young men, the boys, we started calling them, drifting around the courtyard with their guns. The leaders came and went in the Suzuki. It seemed they were staying at a different place, possibly back in Mogadishu. Yahya seemed to be directly in charge of the boys, ordering them around in Somali, sending one or two out to fetch thermoses of sweet tea or bags of cooked spaghetti from some unseen market on the other side of the walls. Ali appeared to be in charge of us. Without his commanders around, he kicked into high gear, barging in and out of the room with a jumpy sort of ferocity. "If your governments don't pay, you will die," he said at one point, looking down at us from the doorway. He dragged a finger dramatically across his own neck to indicate that we would be beheaded. Clearly enjoying the moment, he leaned in close. His voice was high-pitched for a man's. "How does it feel," he said, "knowing you will soon die?" The morning passed minute by minute. Every few hours, we could hear a muezzin call from the mosque and then the shuffle and murmur of prayer outside our door. Nigel lay on his mat, crying softly, keeping one elbow crooked over his face as if he couldn't bear to look at his surroundings. On the previous day, Ali had given us each a brand new piece of fabric, a large square of lightweight cotton. Nigel's was red, and he was wearing it instead of his jeans, wrapped like a skirt around his waist to give his body more air, which was how we'd seen some of our captors dressed. I was sweltering, still in headscarf and abaya with my jeans and tank top beneath, knowing I had no choice but to stay fully cloaked. I'd taken my sheet, which was covered with delicate blue and white flowers, and spread it out to put a layer between me and the moldy floor mat. I made the calculations. Somalia was in a time zone 9 hours ahead of the Canadian Rockies. I wondered, was my family sleeping? Would the kidnappers call them in the middle of the night? I fought off tears. We were behind the high walls, outnumbered by men with guns, and with no sense of where we were on the map. Our helplessness seemed complete. Ali stuck his head through our door again. "How does it feel," he said, "to know you have 20 hours to live?" He made the beheading motion with his finger, this time adding a sound effect, a swift scraping hiss. Then he left again. I tried unsuccessfully to barricade myself off from his words, to push what I knew from my mind. Our captors were fundamentalists, and fundamentalists really did behead people. In Iraq, I'd gone out one day to do a TV story and had visited a field at the outskirts of Sadr City. The place had become a dumping ground for the bodies of people killed in the fighting between Shiite and Sunni militias. A man's decomposing corpse, lying in the ground amid piles of garbage, caught my eye. His hair was matted and his eyes were open, brown and blank. It took me a few seconds to assemble the picture to realize what it was I was seeing. The man's head had been partially severed from his body, the top vertebrae of his spine flashing white like whale bones in the sun. It was a lesson the world had already taught me and was teaching me still. You don't know what's possible until you actually see it. With time ticking down, we were novelties, Nigel and I. With a now-or-never bravado, two of the soldier boys entered our room with lunch and lingered awkwardly in the doorway. They were keen to practice their English. One of them I would actually come to like. Jamal, his name was. He spoke only a small amount of English, but compensated with an eagerness to engage. He sat on the floor cross-legged in a navy blue t-shirt and a pair of tan dress slacks with cuffs that rode high over his skinny dark ankles, and smiled at us in a genuine way. He was a teenager, 18 years old, he said, a clear work in progress with long, spindly legs and narrow shoulders that sloped forward, as if he were trying to shed some of his considerable height. He had bright eyes and dark curly hair cut close to his skull. On his chin, he had a few sprouting hairs, the very beginnings of a beard. I could smell his cologne, fruity and cheap. I remembered Jamal from the day before. He'd been the gunman who'd first appeared at my window. His eyes were unforgettably big and frightened in a way that broadcast his inexperience. Though his face had been wrapped, the scarf had fallen partly open, and I'd seen enough that I could recognize him now. He came to our room with another boy, Abdullah, who was more heavily built and somber-seeming. Abdullah had carried our meals, two more bags of greasy spaghetti, and dropped them quickly into our hands, using only the outer edges of two fingertips, as if we might bite. Jamal, though, was openly curious, only a little bit bashful, averting his eyes when he asked us questions, smiling at the ground as he heard our answers. Where did we live? Were we married? What did we think of Somalia? Did we own cars? Abdullah sat down as well, but he made me uneasy. In a flat voice, he said that he was also 18 and fighting the jihad. Soldier, he said, touching his chest with evident pride. I could feel him looking at me as he said it, even as I avoided meeting his gaze. Both Nigel and I left our food untouched. To eat in front of them felt like putting a weakness on display. Jamal, it turned out, had just gotten engaged to be married. I said, "Is she a beautiful girl?" He dipped his head sheepishly, the grin irrepressible. "Yes, beautiful." "When are you getting married?" Jamal said, "After now." "You mean soon?" "Yes," he said, "inshallah." Searching for words, he added, "The married party is..." He rubbed his two fingers together. "Expensive? A wedding is expensive?" "Yes." He seemed to beam relief, having made himself understood. What he meant by "after now," I realized, was "once this kidnapping is over." It occurred to me that for Jamal, this wasn't so much about jihad. He was waiting for his payout so he could go home, throw a wedding, and marry his girl. "You have 17 hours until you die," Ali said after we'd made a late day trip to the outhouse and resettled ourselves on our mats. Nigel was lying on his side, facing the wall. I found myself hoping Ali would leave and Jamal would come back, bringing his comparative cheer. Nigel had closed himself off. He hadn't managed to say one reassuring or hopeful thing all day. Ali said, sounding angry, "Did you hear me?"
"I heard you."
"You will soon die." My hips were sore from the pressure of the concrete beneath my thin mat. I was feeling drained by the heat. I was sick of his nastiness. "Well," I said, knowing I was being flippant, "if that's how Allah wants it..." Ali's rage was instantaneous. He took a few steps closer as if to strike me. "You," he seethed. "You think this is a joke? If you are ready to die, then say so. I will kill you now." I cowered. "No, no, no, I'm sorry," I said, switching my tone to reflect how I felt. Fear, sustained over a number of hours, feels like something you can drown in. I've been paddling in it all day. Nigel had quietly rolled over on his mat and was listening. I said, "I don't think this is a joke, my brother. I don't want to die." I bowed my head. "But if it's my time, then there's nothing I can do about it." That's all I was trying to say. When I looked up again, Ali seemed to be regarding me carefully. His anger had subsided a little. I regretted saying it. To mock the Muslim belief in predestiny, the idea that Allah had planned our fates carefully and there was little we could do to swerve from them, was sacrilege. A hot-button move, if there ever were one. An idea came to me then, a possibility. If I'm going to die, I said to Ali as calmly as I could, I would like to speak with an imam first. I saw him cock his head in surprise. No, he said after a beat, that is reserved only for the Muslims. There were a lot of things only for the Muslims in Somalia, because everybody, more or less, was Muslim. Well, I said, thinking maybe it would extend us past 24 hours. Maybe I want to become a Muslim before I die. That night, they loaded us back into Ahmed's Suzuki. In a repeat of the initial kidnapping, Nigel and I were pushed in with a bunch of masked men, a few of whom we recognized. I could identify Ahmed, Adam, Ali, and Yahya. Their guns clattered, knocking against the rounds of bullets they wore draped over their shoulders. Adam drove the car. Abdullah, Jamal's angry-seeming friend, rode in the back with his AK-47 pointed at our heads. Ahmed, who had come to fetch us from the room an hour earlier, had given his usual sunny smile and spoken with the unflappable politeness of a 5-star hospitality professional. "Is everything okay?" I'd said. "Oh, yeah, very good," he'd replied. "But what about the 24 hours? He almost looked surprised. "Oh, we will give you more time. No problem. We will take you to a nicer house. I am sorry for these poor beds that you must sleep on." It was impossible to know whether we should believe him. The car slid through the village, spraying sand. Nigel and I held hands tightly. Out the window, I could see no clues to where we were, just walls and low bushes. Adam, in his Ben Franklin glasses, spun the wheel back and forth, revving the engine to get traction. I asked Adam, "Have you spoken to our families?" "Ah, yes, I have." He looked over his shoulder at Nigel. "I talked with your sister." His face broke into a smile, showing the gap of his missing front tooth. "She is... what is the word for it? Panicked." The thought tightened my throat. "My parents?" I said. "Your mother, she is good, very good," Adam said nonchalantly. He offered nothing more. Chapter 19. Electric House. Our new house was close to the old house. After a 10-minute drive, we were dropped in front of another high-walled compound and escorted through a small metal doorway, the group of us filing in like ducks, the boys angling their AK-47s to fit through the door. On the other side was a sand yard and, across it, a single-story house with a wide patio. Someone had strung a few drooping clotheslines across the porch. Inside, it was not much of an upgrade over where we'd come from, though this place had electric lights and a small indoor bathroom with a bucket-flush toilet. A couple of the boys, wordlessly clutching their guns, led us down a hallway and to a damp-feeling room with two stained mattresses on the floor. A forest of black crystallized mold branched across the back wall, running the width of the room. Left on our own, Nigel and I silently pulled the mattresses as far away from it as possible, each picking a different side of the room, careful to keep a distance between us so as not to tick off Ali and his zeal for modesty. Adam carried in several plastic bags, thrusting them in our direction with what I read to be pride, gesturing for us to open them. Nigel was given a couple of new sets of shirts and pants folded tidily. I got a pair of men's jeans and two men's dress shirts, along with a brown sequin skirt that looked small enough to fit a child. All were brand new. Adam had bought me a notebook and a pen, a bottle of Head & Shoulders 2-in-1 shampoo conditioner, some perfume, a bar of soap, a toothbrush, and a family-sized toothpaste. He looked pleased by his own thoughtfulness.
When I glanced over at Nigel, I saw he was holding an identically huge log of toothpaste. It seemed they weren't planning to kill us right away. I felt a tide of relief followed by instant exhaustion. Jesus, I thought, holding my toothpaste. How long are they planning to keep us here? To Adam, I said, Wow, this is a lot of stuff. He seemed flattered. Oh, well, he said, lifting his hands, you are our brother and sister, and you can see that this is the real brand, the Crest toothpaste. Dutifully, Nigel and I fawned over his purchases. I assumed that American toothpaste was neither cheap nor easy to come by in Somalia. Then again, as Adam seemed to be calculating it, he'd soon be on the receiving end of a 7-figure ransom payment that would render all expenses trivial. He smiled and said goodnight. The next several nights were not in any way restful. We'd hear the evening prayers, and then the house would go quiet. The electricity was spotty. The lights clicked off abruptly and on no sort of regular schedule. Nigel and I whispered until he drifted off, covering every meaningless or pleasant topic we could think of. Our pets, our school days, our past travels. In the dark, I could just make out the contours of his face. Sleep, for him, had become a means of escape. By day, his anxieties were so stark and so crippling that he almost didn't resemble himself. Back in the last place, the bomb-making house, he'd combed the room for things he might use to kill himself, the cut wires, the iron coat rack, thinking it was better to stay one step ahead of Ali and his drive to have us beheaded. Lying on my flowered sheet, I listened enviously to Nigel's breathing. Cockroaches skittered in the corners of the room. I wrapped the two edges of the sheet over me and rolled to make it tight, like a cocoon, as I lay on my side. In the bathroom at the new house, I thought of it as the electric house. Our captors brought us water in a brown bucket from a pump outside, which we used to wash and pour down the toilet as a flush. Before going to bed, before the lights went off, I splashed water over as much of my body as I could, too afraid to remove any piece of clothing, exposing my skin only in pieces, unsnapping the abaya to run a hand over my clavicles, pulling up the loose sleeves to get to my arms, keeping my pants down long enough after using the toilet to douse myself quickly between the legs. The water felt like a relief, though I was far from clean. But it was relative. Everything was relative. One day's worries were either greater or lesser than the previous day's worries. What I lay with at night was the fear of being raped. I was the lone woman in a house that included, by my count, 12 men, in addition to Ahmed and Adam, who continued to sleep elsewhere. 4 of them were prisoners. Nigel and I had been relieved to hear Abdi and our driver and security guard, Marwali and Mahad, their names were, moved into a room next to ours, if only because it meant they hadn't been killed. We could see their shoes piled on the floor in the hallway outside their door. The house hummed with what I can only describe as male energy, a buzzy mix of repression and young strength. I felt it when the boys came to deliver food, when their eyes fell on me and then quickly moved away, as if the sight of me, or whatever thought that followed, was shameful. I felt it in the afternoons, when Ali plunked himself down on the floor of our room and went on one of his long rants about how the Western countries, the Christians, were to blame for the war in Somalia. He seemed to view me with a mixture of intrigue and disgust, much like he viewed the world beyond Somalia. "Your women," he said to Nigel one day, scooping his hands so they looked like splayed breasts. Then he trailed off, lacking the words, his lips curled in distaste. Pointedly, he did not look in my direction. I felt it most, though, in those hours spent in the darkness, my sheet and the polyester abaya making a flimsy barrier between me and them, in the moments when I heard a rustle or a grunt from somewhere in the house. I was an aberration, an enemy to their morals, and also fully powerless. With me, they seemed unsure what to do. You see, Ahmed said to me at one point, suggesting that the original plan had been to kidnap the National Geographic guys off the road. We were told it would be two men. Midway through the first week, Ahmed showed up at the house and handed me his cell phone. "Talk to your mother," he said. I took the phone and held it to my ear. "Mom?" I said. And there was her voice saying my name. The line crackled and faded, and for a second she didn't seem real. Ahmed had put the phone on speaker. He gestured for me to hold it away from my head so he could listen. There was a split-second delay between what my mother said and when I heard it, causing our voices to overlap uselessly. "Are you okay?" I asked. "Well, no, not really. Are you okay?" "Yeah, we're okay," I said. Her voice cut over mine. "Okay. We're okay." It felt as if the two of us were swimming between enormous ocean waves, dropping in and out of each other's sight, shouting into walls of water. She told me that she loved me, that people at home were praying for us. She asked if Nigel was with me. She said that they were trying to get some money together. Those were the words she used, get some money together. What that meant, I couldn't imagine. I asked what the ransom demand was. My mother hesitated and then replied, $1.5 million, she said. My mother and I were silent for a few seconds. The money was an impossibility, we both knew. My mother stuttered. "Amanda," she said, is there any ideas that you can think of?" I wasn't sure what she was asking. Later, I would learn that she was being coached by a negotiator from the RCMP, one of a number of people listening in on the phone call. My mother was now living in a government-rented home in Sylvan Lake, which doubled as the RCMP's headquarters. She and the negotiator were trying to figure out how firm the demands were, whether we were safe, and who was keeping us. Meanwhile, I was sitting in our room in the electric house surrounded by my captors, Ahmed and several of the others, as my mother's voice entered the room, their world sounding tinny and weak. "No," I said, feeling the tears begin to brim. I tried to think of something, anything to tell her, but before I could say more, the line disconnected and she was gone. I began to obsess over the idea that Nigel and I needed to stay together, that we had to do all we could to keep them from separating us. Even as he confused our captors by weeping openly in front of them, Nigel was still more familiar to them. Because he was a man, he was accorded more respect. Because we were together, we were treated more or less the same. I hung on to this, knowing his proximity helped keep me safe. When the leader showed up at the house, every other day or so, I did my best to appear composed and businesslike, delivering the same messages again and again. Our families had no money. Our governments wouldn't pay. Sometimes Nigel joined me in reinforcing the message. Other times he dripped silent tears, following my instructions not to say anything that sounded desperate or emotional. Having discarded the hope that some easy negotiation could take place, my new hope was that after a few weeks or a month, our captors would get tired and give up. Every day I worked to make myself, to make us, harder to kill by being friendly and remaining neutral on politics and religion. If we could bore them without frustrating them, I figured, maybe they'd deliver us back to the Shamo, just like two boxes that had spent a month uselessly collecting dust in a warehouse. "How is your situation?" Ahmed said each time he greeted us, stepping into the dark room, looking every bit the visiting nobleman in a clean shirt and pressed khakis. There were two answers. There was the one I wanted to scream, that our situation sucked, thank you very much, and the one that maintained the status quo, that kept the basic arrangement undisturbed, which, given that we were together, receiving two basic meals a day, and had toothpaste to last an eternity, seemed the better choice. "Our situation is okay," I'd tell Ahmed, "but we want to go home." "Ah, yes," he would say. "We are working on that." When the leaders weren't around, the boys loitered in our room, mostly focused on Nigel. They looked him in the eye. In faltering English, they asked about sports and cars, which seemed to break him out of his depression for short stints. Slowly, we were learning their names. There was Ismail, who was 14, and a boy whose name was Yahya, same as the older captains. There was a Yusuf and two Muhammads and another soldier who seemed sweet, like Jamal, whose name was Hassam. Each one of them carried a cell phone, an AK-47, and a tiny edition of the Quran, about the size of a deck of cards, tucked into his shirt pocket. Around me, the boys were more cautious. Most, I assumed, had never spent time close to a woman who wasn't a family member. I worked constantly to demystify myself. I learned there was a benefit in mentioning, again and again, that I'd lived in Afghanistan and Iraq, and traveled in places like Pakistan, Sudan, and Syria. They felt a kinship with these countries, especially Afghanistan and Iraq, where Islamic soldiers were fighting, as they saw it, infidel invaders. Anytime I showed even a vague familiarity with Islamic tradition or culture, acknowledging that Ramadan was soon to start, recalling the beauty of the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem or the time I'd traveled through Tora Bora, they seemed to become slightly less suspicious of me, more eager to engage. Jamal, it was clear, had been born almost too happy for his circumstances. Misery didn't suit him. He loped in and out of our room, bringing us flasks of tea or small bunches of green bananas. Almost always, he wore an effervescent smile. There were moments when he burst out laughing, having understood one of Nigel's weak wisecracks, and then clamped a hand over his mouth as if to stuff his delight back inside. After one of his trips to the market, he smuggled in a couple packs of cigarettes and handed them off to Nigel, looking pleased by his own naughtiness. When Jamal came for a visit, Abdullah often tagged along, the Hyde to his Jekyll, unwilling to laugh or be casual, but listening with interest to everything we said. Even as most of the other boys had stopped wearing scarves over their faces in our presence, Abdullah kept himself carefully swathed. He sat close to me, his eyes flashing an emotion I couldn't read, his nose and mouth buried between folds of checkered cotton. He asked me questions about the Mujahideen fighters in Afghanistan, what kind of guns they carried, how they dressed, whether they had cars. Slowly, we began to extract information. Most of the boys had gone to some form of training camp to learn to be a soldier. Ismail, the 14-year-old, had been schooled in insurgent warfare somewhere out in the desert. Jamal had joined the Mujahideen out of grief and duty. His father had been killed a couple of years earlier by Ethiopian troops, he told us. His mother was still alive. The memory of losing his father was fresh enough that it caused his eyes to water. For me, this was start of jihad, he said. Before jihad, we learned, Ahmed and Adam had both worked as teachers. The older Yahya had been a farmer. Before jihad, some of the younger boys had gone to school. Now, they got paid to fight, though it wasn't much. I knew from my research that funding for the insurgency in Somalia flowed in from other countries, raised through radical Islamic networks. Some, it was believed, came from the fat ransoms paid for ships held hostage by pirates in the Gulf of Aden. From where I sat, the group holding us captive looked to be a straight-up hierarchy. The leaders, Ahmed, Adam, and a third tall man we'd come to call Romeo, appeared to be reasonably well off, with cars and expensive-looking clothes. Captain Yahya and Ali seemed to be the middle management, while the boys had been given little more than a weapon, housing, and food, plus the conviction that Allah was behind them. Jihad in Arabic means the struggle. There are two types in Islam, the greater and the lesser. Both are seen as noble. The greater jihad is inward, the lifelong striving of any Muslim to be a better person, to ward off temptation and desire, to maintain faith. The lesser jihad is outward and communal and violent when called for, the struggle to defend and assert that faith. For our captors, the jihad involved fighting the Ethiopians, although our kidnapping was wrapped into the cause. Not only did we come from bad countries, as Ali put it, But any ransom money they got, he said, would get channeled back into the larger fight. It seemed that the young men were organized into cells, getting called out for combat in the streets of Mogadishu or elsewhere when necessary. From what we could gather, most of the boys had been living at home right up until the day we'd been taken on the road to Afgoya, a task for which their cell had been activated, by whom we couldn't be sure. While Jamal brimmed with plans for his life after the kidnapping, he would get married, then study information technology in India, since he'd heard there were many universities there, Abdullah seemed stuck on the war. One day I asked what he was going to do later in life. He gave me a fierce look, mimed the act of putting on a jacket, and made the sound of an explosion. It took me a second. Suicide bomber? Abdullah nodded. Martyr was how he saw it. At the gates to paradise, soldiers in God's army got to enter through a special doorway. Jamal shook his head. He waved his hand back and forth as if to say, no, no, no. Like me, he had an idea that life could again be normal, that all of this could be rolled back. I don't want him to die, he explained. He is my friend. Chapter 20. Amina. Why are you not Muslim? Ali wanted to know one morning, having surfaced in our room, seeming a little bored. Why don't you pray? He'd expressed this confusion before, perplexed by the idea that our days could be ungoverned by scheduled prayer, whereas his fell so neatly into five slices, the several hours between each appointment with Allah, from the first one in the early morning to the last in the evening. For our spiritual idleness, Ali was certain we were going to hell. He'd said this to us previously, too, in angry condemnation of who we were, but today he seemed less spiteful. It was hot already, hotter than usual. The air in our room smelled like a bog. Ali sat with his back against the wall. He sighed. It is better to pray, he said. It occurred to me that were our situations reversed, if Ali were captive and unmoored from everything he knew, he would manage to keep his appointments, to live by the order imposed by his faith. As my own days felt increasingly like a long wait for nothing, I realized there was probably strength in that. During prayer times, we could hear Abdi and the two other Somali captives reciting their Arabic in the room next to ours. Talking religion with Ali was something we did cautiously, and only during his calmer moments when he was not raging about one thing or another. Nigel at one point attempted to say he leaned toward Buddhism, but Ali wasn't interested. We know how to pray, brother, I said, deliberately not looking at Nigel, who had not been raised with a formal religion and was capable of objecting. We just have to learn more about the Muslim way. I asked if Ali had an English-language copy of the Quran he could loan us, just to look at. This appeared to make Ali happy. I will check in the Bukhara market, he said, looking from me to Nigel. Inshallah, there is one there. Bukhara market was a well-known area in central Mogadishu, a place where people sold food and supplies and weapons. Before we were kidnapped, I'd asked Ajos if we could visit, and he just laughed. Impossible, he'd told me. Bukhara Market is a base for Al-Shabaab. Very, very dangerous for white people. Inshallah, I said back to Ali. I was floating a balloon of willingness. I knew from my time in Iraq that at least for some Muslims, it was not considered such a leap for someone to move from Christianity to Islam. The two religions worship the same God under different names. The Muslim faith acknowledged Moses and Jesus, Musa and Isa, they were called. It acknowledged the Torah, the Psalms, and the Gospels as revelations from God. To convert, you needed to declare Muhammad the prophet of record, the one whose path you were ready to follow. I told Ali I had read the Bible many times. I told him I'd spent my childhood on my knees, that my grandparents were very religious. He picked up on what I was saying immediately. Then you are 50% Muslim already, he said. He gestured somewhat grandly with one hand. You only have to say the Shahada, the Islamic declaration of faith, and you will go to paradise. Nigel gave me an impatient look. He knew what I was doing and didn't like it. We had talked once or twice about pretending to accept Islam, asking to convert. He was solidly against it, thinking it was too big a risk. If we got caught faking their religion, the thing they took more seriously than anything, he said, we'd surely be killed. I argued the other side. Our captors would have to treat us well if we converted. They'd have no choice but to see us as fellow believers. They'd have to be more charitable. For me, it would be a way to distance myself from my Western woman image. My freedom, my travels and work, my way of dressing and talking, my life unyoked to a husband or family, was a taunt. The sooner I could reinvent myself, the better I'd do. Ali stood up, brushed the dirt from the floor off his pants, and left the room. Nigel glared at me. "No fucking way," he said. "Don't do this." He relocated himself to the far side of the room, carefully keeping his distance from the mold on the wall, but also from me. On cue, a fuzzy-sounding loudspeaker nearby kicked on. The muezzin, different from the one we'd heard at the last house, this one older-sounding, cleared his throat into the microphone a few times and began to chant the call to prayer. Nigel exhaled loudly and shook his head. "Look, you can become a Muslim," he said, "but I'm not going to." We couldn't afford to divide, I knew that much. I sighed too. "That won't work, Nigel," I said. "If I do it and you don't, then they'll move me out of here for sure. You can't have a Muslim woman living with a non-Muslim man." "Right," he said. And that was it. We were in a standoff. Conversion, we both knew, was an all-or-nothing move. I let the subject drop. The window in our room was open to the air but covered by several iron bars. It looked out at another house. Every so often, we could hear the noises of the family living there. Kids playing, parents talking, laughter. I caught a glimpse of a woman's back, but I felt too nervous to call out, worried she'd start yelling. Our only interaction at the window was with a cat, a skinny orange creature that one afternoon leaped from the alleyway onto our sill. We were allowed to come and go freely from the bathroom attached to the room. There, high in the wall that faced the courtyard, opposite the toilet, was a vent, a 1-foot by 2-foot piece of scroll work cut into the concrete to let fresh air inside. Nigel and I soon figured out that if we craned our necks while standing on tiptoe, we could see through it to a small wedge of the yard where our captors passed most of their time. The bathroom vent became our portal, our television set, our news station. It was something to monitor. We took turns watching one morning as a new guy showed up in the courtyard, carrying a yellow plastic bag. He was fat, middle-aged, and well-dressed. He walked hunched over as if the weight of his belly were too much for him, as if he'd been thin all his life and wasn't used to carrying his bulk. He greeted Ali and old Yahya in the way that was customary between Somali men, offering a hug on one side and a hug on the other. He took a moment to inspect the courtyard, then pulled from his bag a 6-inch thick wad of Somali shillings, the local currency. He handed it to the captain. They talked for a few minutes before the guy left again. This was how we knew there was a money man, somebody funding the operation or delivering money on behalf of whoever was funding it. From here on out, the man would arrive at least once a week, bringing money and supplies for our captors. Once or twice, we saw him carrying a big pot of home-cooked food and leaving it with the boys. We nicknamed him Donald Trump. Through our spy hole, we watched the boys doing military drills and fitness routines to pass the time. Following the lead of the heavy-set, dark-skinned boy called Yusuf, they performed marches and squat thrusts and did bicep curls as if holding invisible dumbbells. Sometimes Captain Yahya would referee wrestling matches, pausing the action every so often to demonstrate a certain kind of hold. We would eventually nickname him Skids, since the boys sometimes complained to us privately that he was too strict with them, that he put the brakes on things, that he always said no. The vent gave me things to look at, but it didn't give me hope. I stood on my tiptoes until my calves throbbed, trying to spot something that might signal a way out. The idea of escape felt fruitless. There were too many people crammed into too small a space for anything to happen undetected, and there was only a single exit point, the small door in the heavy metal gate at the edge of the yard. The walls of the compound had been topped with razor wire. Somewhere beyond it, the craggy-voiced muezzin cranked up another call to the faithful, signaling to all it was time to stand up and point themselves the same way. One morning, a few days after we'd discussed it, Ali arrived in our room carrying two thick books bound in navy blue leather, the covers adorned with intricate gold embossing and, written in English, the words, the Holy Quran. He handed them to us with apparent pride, one for me and one for Nigel. They were brand new. The pages inside were tissue thin, the verses written in tiny print, the original Arabic on one side, an English translation on the other. The truth is, I would have devoured any book handed to me, anything to feed my gnawing mind, but the Quran, in that particular moment, felt like a gift from heaven. It was like getting the key to an intricate code. I'd been allowed to speak with my mother twice more in the first 7 days we were held hostage. Both calls had lasted under a minute. Neither yielded anything but proof that I was alive. Nigel had been granted a single call with his sister Nikki for what seemed to be the same purpose. We agreed that help or release did not seem to be coming soon. I read the book in hopes of using their religion to talk my way out. Both Nigel and I read for hours, for several days straight. We said very little to each other during that time, handling the books carefully, storing them on the ledge of the window when we ate or went to the bathroom. Seeing how intent we were, Ali allowed us out into the yard a couple of times, gesturing for us to sit on a low, round wall that encircled the skinny papaya tree. The yard was dry and hot. The boys lounged with their guns, ignoring us. I went page by page through the Quran, trying to ignore the fear roiling inside me. I looked for strands of logic, for insights into the minds of my captors. I cross-referenced one bit of information against another. The Quran was dense, poetic in some places, dictatorial in others, its messages often mixed. There were many verses about jihad and enemies alongside many about kindness and mercy. Paradise was dangled like a sumptuous fruit. Women were most often described as wives. The Arabic phrase for captives or slaves was, "those whom your right hand possesses." The book was explicit about what such possession meant. You were basically owned by your captors. There were verses instructing that captives be treated with kindness and granted freedom if they were well behaved. There were others that made clear that a female captive was fair game sexually. In a couple of verses where the Quran forbade men to have sex outside of marriage, there was a worrisome little clause tacked on at the end, "except with those whom your right hand possesses." We would have to focus on being well behaved and appeal to their sense of mercy. The book gave us some power. It gave us language to use, lines of reasoning to apply. It was like getting a look at the operating system that ran our captors' lives. I found two notions that seemed like they might make a difference. A believer is not supposed to kill a fellow believer, and a believing slave is given more lenience than an unbelieving slave. "Nigel," I said, "they can't kill us if we convert." He, too, had found the same verses, but still he was worried about the risk. Converting would feel false, he said. It could insult them. It was too dangerous. I was remembering the back of the throat ripping sound Ali had made when dragging a finger across his neck, explaining how we would be killed. I was willing to be false if it gave us more leverage. I woke up on the 11th morning of our captivity, knowing it was time. Nothing was changing. It felt like we had to make a move, to force some sort of energy shift. Nigel's spirit seemed dangerously low. He sat on his mattress, sullenly reading the Quran. He started talking about Allah and Islam. I seized the moment, saying the words before I could think too hard about them. "I think we're ready to say the Shahada," I told Ali, bowing my head to appear modest and also to avoid looking at Nigel. Ali was unhesitant in his jubilation.